He certainly has sensitivities about U.S. presence in the Philippines.
Philippines president wants a halt to new U.S. arms depots. It's Tuesday, January 31st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Welcome, and join us online right now by logging on to Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, how best to deal with Myanmar's Rohingya. Migrant workers in China want their pay. Cambodians leave home to find work. And Lunar New Year celebrations in Vietnam. We're just getting started. Stay with us on VOA Asia. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has called on the United States to stop building arms depots in his country.
They are unloading arms in the Philippines now. Dito sa Palawan, Cagayan de Oro, pati Pampanga. I'm serving notice to the armed forces of the United States. Do not do it. I will not allow it. First of all, merong provision doon sa visiting forces command. There shall no be permanent facilities. A depot by any other name is a depot. It's a permanent structure to house arms.
Mr. Duterte suggested he might scrap a bilateral security treaty if the U.S. persists. Under the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement reached in 2014, Washington is permitted to pre-position supplies, equipment, and material for defense, disaster relief, and humanitarian purposes, but cannot have a permanent base. Gerard Finnan, a senior fellow at the Hawaii-based East-West Institute, was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty whether Mr. Duterte's position has a distinctly anti-American tone.
Well, he certainly has sensitivities about U.S. presence in the Philippines and thinks of himself as a Filipino nationalist. What it will really mean with the new administration still is unclear to me. I think that the military-to-military cooperation amongst the armed forces of the Philippines officer corps and the U.S. officers is still very good. It's an evolving situation, and it seems to me that he may actually change his position once he and Mr. Trump start talking more seriously.
What is behind his rhetoric?
There's always been some, as I say, sensitivity by Mr. Duterte about the way in which he believes the U.S. has operated in the Philippines. Of course, as a former colony, there are also sensitivities related to the historical relationship. I think that he may feel the U.S. has not shown enough deference to the wishes of the Philippine government over the recent years, but it also is reflective of the fact that he wants to work more closely with China than his predecessor did.
The Duterte government has some controversy, of course, on its hand aside from the U.S., and that is that police are suspending their anti-narcotics operation until they say they've cleansed their ranks of quote-unquote scalawags following the killing by strangulation of a South Korean businessman in this anti-drug effort that has taken thousands of lives.
I think there are three questions related to this development. The first is, after thousands of Filipinos have reportedly been summarily executed without a trial, why did Mr. Duterte only reconsider his policy when a South Korean was killed? I guess the second question I would ask is all this talk about the South Korean businessman who died related to worries about scaring foreign direct investment away, or is it about returning the Philippines to a place that respects the rule of law? The third question I would ask is it clear that the dissolution of the so-called drug enforcement groups within the police department will actually put a stop to extrajudicial killings now, or will they simply be reconstituted under a different name somewhere down the road?
Mr. Duterte, who made fighting drugs and crime a central part of his 2016 election campaign, on Sunday vowed to keep on fighting through his six-year term, which ends in 2022. The bloody anti-drug crackdown, which has claimed about 7,000 lives so far, has for the moment been suspended in response to that kidnapping and brutal murder of a South Korean businessman by anti-narcotics officers. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Malaysia searching for six missing at sea detains two boat crew. India gets respite after Trump abandons TPP. UN social media posts removed in China after backlash. Thai media legislation triggers protests. Is the Rohingya situation improving in Myanmar? You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Myanmar has been under growing international pressure over its months-long brutal security operations in Rohingya Muslim communities in Rakhine State, and last week saw another barrage of criticism from Malaysia and a United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur. But the democratic government of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi has resisted the pressure and defended the military against allegations of massive rights abuses, to the frustration of the international community, where many have launched harsh criticisms of the democracy idol. The complexities of the Rakhine crisis have prompted calls for a change in the approach of foreign governments to dealing with Myanmar's National League for Democracy government and the army. David Matheson, a former Myanmar researcher for Human Rights Watch, said the international community would do well to shift some pressure away from Aung San Suu Kyi, as her government has no control over the army under Myanmar's constitution.
A major thing that they can do right now is to reorient valid criticism of what's going on away from the state councillor, Aung San Suu Kyi, and the actual perpetrators, the Tatmadaw and the police.
Matheson says regional governments should urgently come up with a unified response toward Myanmar over the Rakhine crisis.
There's no real unified approach. You've got the OIC and regional states in ASEAN taking a very, very hard line, but not necessarily working as a united front with other states to actually suggest ways to improve the situation.
He stresses the Rohingya issue is a regional situation.
When it's been clear for many, many years that the Rohingya issue is a regional issue that involves Bangladesh, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand.
David Matheson says Western and Asian governments that began engaging with the Myanmar military in recent years to encourage the country's democratic transition should now slow down and recalibrate their interactions to better pressure the army. The EU delegation to Myanmar told VOA in a statement that the Myanmar army chief was in Brussels in November on a long-planned meeting. However, Matheson says the optics of that visit didn't help.
It certainly sends the wrong signal. And, you know, it was unfortunate timing that he was being feted in Europe while his forces were burning Mongdor.
Indonesia, ASEAN's largest Muslim-majority country, has taken a quieter approach, sending its foreign minister to Myanmar several times. But so far, Jakarta has not tried to initiate a regionally united response towards Myanmar.
And then he had donated something to for the IDPs, but the government didn't allow them to donate by their hands. So they didn't invite the suffering people. They invite from Yangon, but the Yangon people are not suffering like us. So how can they know about the situation on the ground?
Myanmar Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Ai So said it welcomed Indonesia's approach, but rejected Malaysia's and other harsh international criticism of Aung San Suu Kyi's handling of the Rakhine crisis.
Half the time, the news, the things that the international community yelling are not exactly productive or not exactly problem-solving focus. It's more focused more on self-interest.
Ai So denied the Rakhine crisis required the involvement of regional governments.
Purely, you know, our domestic issue that we have to solve in our own way, because these are our people and we are the only one who know what's happening on the ground.
According to United Nations agencies, the security operations have caused 66,000 Rohingya to flee to Bangladesh and internally displaced 22,000 more, while aid access has been restricted. We invite your comments and observations on our Facebook page, VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, the executive order U.S. President Donald Trump signed temporarily banning travelers from 7 countries sparked protests in the United States and elsewhere. Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim country, was not included on the list, but expressed regret about the policy. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. China's annual holiday migration of millions of workers who flock to the country's richer coastal cities for jobs has already begun. But some are not going home and have instead taken to the streets to protest because their employees have yet to pay them. Disputes over pay at this time of year are not uncommon. Keegan Elmer, labor researcher of China Labor Bulletin, tells VOA the difference this year is employers in newer industries are being pressed for back wages.
Old economy has the same old issues. Construction, everything from old industries like steel, coal, these older industries still have the same problems of wage arrears. And the new economy, it turns out, for example, delivery workers in the online to offline market or new online e-commerce industries are showing the same issues of wage arrears. So now the problem's even gotten worse in some respects.
Zhou Jianhai and 20 of his fellow villagers from Hubei province traveled to Shanxi province in 2015 to finish work on an oil rigging project. But they are still missing the final payment of some 530,000 yuan, or more than $77,000, from their subcontractor employer. We couldn't get by without this small amount of money, which hasn't arrived yet. Each of us has to work to support his family of five or six, Joe says as he spoke to VOA from Xi'an, where he and 15 other villagers have staged a protest in front of the oil company's headquarters. He adds, the employer now asks us to go home, saying that we will be paid after the Chinese New Year, but we can't keep taking their words for it. We plan to hold on to our protest until we're paid. There's no other way but to spend the Chinese New Year here. Joe said they had petitioned their case to two government offices and the local court. While the subcontractor finally agreed to pay in full, they still haven't received their pay. Joe added their priority is to make their ends meet regardless of government help. New labor regulations are well intended, but no one from the local labor supervision department, public bureau, and the courts seems to be able to implement them. The court, which has heard our case for 6 to 7 months, still hasn't enforced the recovery of our wage arrears. China Labor Bulletin's Keegan Elmer believes the government should allow workers to have their own oversight mechanism or take a participatory role in the management of their employers.
For example, the regular collective bargaining, which is something that we advocate here, gives workers a role in encouraging transparency and dialogue with the bosses to make sure that workers know when the company's having trouble or if there's some sort of conflict, there's a way that they can solve these conflicts before they erupt into some dangerous and sometimes violent conflict.
Labor disputes are also gaining increasing attention on social media in China, but few are optimistic the problem will improve soon. Have you worked but have not received your pay? Let us know on Facebook. This is VOA Asia.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Police arrested a 53-year-old man for the killing of Kony in Myanmar. Rights group Amnesty International called for a thorough and impartial investigation. Kony had criticized the military and received numerous death threats. The ruling NLD party said there was no substitute for his great loss. This story and more on Steve Miller's Asia in a Minute, all found on VOA Asia Facebook. Each year, millions leave their home countries to work in foreign countries. VOA Asia's Steve Miller speaks with Kim Sing Min of VOA's Khmer Service to learn more about where Cambodians are going to work and some of the challenges they face.
Cambodian workers traveled a lot to mainly countries in Southeast Asia. As of now, we don't have exact figure, but approximately between 1 million to 1.5 million Cambodians leave the country to work either in Thailand, South Korea, Japan, Malaysia, the Philippines, China, but mostly in Thailand, because a lot of them are undocumented.
Mm.
Yeah, that's why it's easy to cross the border. Sometimes it's a day trip and then come back. Some stay there, for several months, or because seasonal workers.
So if we're talking about migrant workers going out of Cambodia to work in these other countries, there's really two different sets of populations. One would be the documented workers, mm-hmm. and one being the undocumented workers.
Exactly.
So can you break down what people are doing?
For those who are documented, they go mostly to Korea. They work in some work in kind of farm, work in some industry like car. But to Thailand, most of them work in a plantation, agriculture, and also construction workers. And some also work at a fishing industry in Thailand.
Now, are there any specific instances of rights violations that people are addressing?
They are more undocumented than those with proper documentation. And they end up being exploited and either into sex slave, either into hard labor, or being tortured, and a lot have been reported. For example, like the guest whom I invited last week, only his organization alone in 2006 documented over 200 that he helped. And those happened in Japan, in Thailand, in Korea, in China as well. Another guest of mine that was in the show last week, who was a lawmaker, said she is trying to work with her counterpart in other countries to ensure that the workers' rights are protected, because as you know that in ASEAN they only protect those with skill, and a lot of Cambodian migrant workers are unskilled, so they fall out of this category of protection.
Right, and this is a story that we hear also from other nations within ASEAN, especially
exactly.
when it comes to migrant workers working in unskilled or perhaps undocumented cases.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Sung Min from our Khmer Service, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for the opportunity.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Philippine police suspend a controversial anti-drug operation following the kidnapping and brutal murder of a South Korean businessman by anti-narcotics officers. Local anti-narcotics units will aim to purge rogue officers as President Rodrigo Duterte vows to continue the drug war through 2022. VOA keeps you informed on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, we continue our celebration of the Year of the Rooster as we hear from our VOA correspondents who cover Asia. Vietnamese reporter Tra My joins us for some of the traditions at this time of year in Vietnam.
In my country, people like take almost the whole month break, doing nothing, not working, not doing anything, just enjoying. The first 3 days are the most important ones. We dress up very nicely, usually in red color, because red symbolizes luck. We line up and we wish the parents, the grandparents, and in return, the older would give the younger one lucky money in
yes.
red envelopes.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a must. You cannot get around with it. And then after collecting, money, it's time for the whole family to sit together, have meal together. And after the first meal of the day, we gamble.
Oh,
yes.
There you go.
And usually,
with the money from the envelope?
Yeah, of course. And usually on the first day of the new year, you don't go to anybody's house, just your family. Because people believe that the first day should be the most sacred day. Around noon, people would go to temple. Because most of the people in my country are Buddhists.
Right.
So we go to the temple to pray for the good new year and to pray for our, ancestors, praying for the best things for our family members and for everybody. On the second day of the Tet, people would go from house to house, from families to friends, or even to your teachers' houses. We come, we visit, we have meal together, and we send wishes. And then on the third days of the new year, usually we go to events like food fair, flower fair, all kind of fairs, and participate in contests. There's a lot of contests.
How is it different between Vietnam and celebrating it here in the U.S.?
Here, basically, we stick around with family and we try to keep our traditions as much as we can because we don't have that much of an atmosphere or the chemistry here. Usually, if it doesn't fall on a weekend, we just go to work and then we celebrate it with the community the weekend before the New Year starts.
All right. So you can spend perhaps the evenings with family and friends and have a series of weekend events.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. The community usually have something for the whole Vietnamese in the community to get together, all especially right. musical performances. You know, here in the U.S., people are still watching on YouTube, on social media, to follow what's going on there. Before, we used to have firecrackers in my country, but now it's a ban. So here, Vietnamese in the U.S. can have firecrackers on TED, but not in Vietnam anymore for like years ago.
Interesting. Yeah. So now, I guess, with a lot of social media and you have Skype and those things available, mm-hmm. you can do some of the tradition here that people in your homeland can't.
Yes, and we're very well connected. We go Facebook Live to show them, oh, this is what we're doing here. And we have a family reunion online like that.
Okay, yeah. We're on our way.
For the whole week. Okay.
Trami, thank you.
You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
Well, we're all very well connected, and we're glad that you've been connected with us listening to VOA Asia, whether it was over an open-air radio station or on Facebook at VOA Asia. Anyways, fine. You can always find us as well at voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer is Dave Magnus, managing editor Diane Gao, and of course, a great thanks to our VOA Asia team as always, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, and Eli Zimmerman. I'm Jim Stevenson, we're all in Washington. Thanks so much. Join us again tomorrow and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the fundraising and support network of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. In pursuit of that goal, on January 10, 2017, the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated four individuals as specially designated global terrorists, pursuant to Executive Order 13224, which targets terrorists and those providing support to terrorists or acts of terrorism. The individuals designated include ISIL members based in Iraq, Syria, and Indonesia who are involved in ISIL's propaganda, recruitment, and support networks in Southeast Asia and Australia. As a result of OFAC's actions, all property and interests in property of these individuals subject to U.S. jurisdiction are blocked, and U.S. persons are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with them. The first designee is Neil Christopher Prakash, who was named for acting for or on behalf of ISIL. He served as ISIL's most senior Australian recruiter and encouraged others to travel to Syria and Iraq to join ISIL. As of June 2015, Prakash was publicly identified as a top ISIL recruiter who facilitated the travel of new recruits, appeared in high-profile ISIL recruitment videos, and was named in a list of key contacts for aspiring ISIL foreign fighters. Khalid Sharouf is a Syria and Iraq-based ISIL member who has been involved in distributing propaganda and carrying out executions on behalf of ISIL. Barumsia Minor Usman is an ISIL official who commands ISIL fighters, facilitates funding for ISIL operations in Indonesia, recruits for ISIL, and coordinates travel and communications for ISIL members. Oman Rahman was designated for acting for or on behalf of ISIL in the areas of recruitment and media dissemination, and as of late 2015, was considered to be the de facto leader for all ISIL supporters in Indonesia, despite his incarceration in Indonesia since December 2010. These designations aim to cut off ISIL's access to the international financial system and support the global coalition's efforts to disrupt ISIL's finances and defeat the terrorist group. As ISIL seeks to recruit individuals around the world, the U.S. government will continue to target its enablers wherever they may be.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.